follow this issue. And a little correction earlier in the headlines. I talked about Franklin Graham, the president of the Christian Relief Organization Samaritan's Purse, who's helped to organize a hospital outside of Mount Sinai here in New York in the middle of Central Park. I mentioned he was university president. He isn't. That's Jerry Falwell, who kept Liberty University open despite the concern of many staff, teachers, and students. That does it for our show. By the way, whether or not we have access to medical masks, using a scarf is a great idea when you go outside. We must all protect ourselves to protect the community. All safety to everyone. Juan, thanks so much for joining us. Democracy Now! Produced by a remarkable team. Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warnoff, Libby Rainey, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Dennis Moynihan, Trina Nadura, Tamari Astudio, Adriana Contreras. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Be safe, all.
Listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, Wednesday Talk Radio.
Yeah, and good morning. This is Paul Rowland. I'm the regular host for Wednesday Talk Radio, speaking from my home in Montevilla, as all the other talk shows have to do remotely, as you know well by now. This is the first Wednesday focus on mental and emotional health and liberation and exploring grassroots alternatives to the existing institutional framework for dealing with people in crisis. Today we're going to be talking about the mental health challenges of the coronavirus pandemic, both the challenges that individuals are having and feeling, as well as the challenges to the mental health system itself. My guest is going to be Robert Nickel, who's the executive director of the MAD in America Continuing Education Project and associate professor in the Public Psychiatry Training Program at Oregon Health and Science University. He was the state of Oregon's commissioner for both mental health and addictions from 2003 to 2008, and he's a member of the executive committee of the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care. He has published extensively in the areas of consumer-operated case management services and many other things. And I will welcome in a moment, before I do that, the Rethinking Psychiatry event, which is also on the first Wednesday of every month, that I have featured often on this program. This month is not going to be in person, as you can imagine, but it is going to be streamed live from Seattle. The speaker will be Alita Wright, who will be speaking on transcending oppression, how the mental health and legal systems keep other oppressions in place, and the interlocking nature of all oppressions, and more. I could read her extensive biography and what she's about, but you can go to the Rethinking Psychiatry website, which is linked on my program page, or you can just go there directly. My program page, of course, is at kboo.fm, Wednesday Talk Radio. That will be starting at 7 o'clock, and it will also be available on the Rethinking Psychiatry website and Facebook page later on. So with that, let me bring up my guest, Bob Nickel. Good morning, Bob.
Bob, can you hear us?
Hello, Bob?
Yes, this is Bob.
Good morning. So we're not going to be able to take direct callers. I know that there is both our regular audience in the in our terrestrial radio listening area as well as on the Internet. And I know there's some people, some of your friends and colleagues from around the country are listening in. They can call the 503-231-8187 number and relay their questions or comments to our board operator, Tammy. I also have a Facebook page, which I hope I have activated properly. It's KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio. So if you're on Facebook and you want to go right to that and like it, and you can hopefully post your comments and questions there, and I will get to them. And I think some people might have my cell phone as well. If they do, they can text me there. So with that, Bob, I came across an article on the KGW, by KGW. I thought I had it up here on my page, but not. Anyway, oh yes, it's called Oregon's Burdened Mental Health System Faces New Challenges from Coronavirus, and it featured some quotes from you. And you want to just pick it up as to, you know, why they contacted you and what you've been thinking about all this?
Well, they contacted me because the reporters from the Lund Report, Ben Botkin, and I asked him, why did you contact me? And he said that I'm on a list of resources that they have at the Lund Report. I have talked with reporters there before. So I think, you know, the fact that I've been a state mental health commissioner gives me a different perspective maybe than some people might have. I've actually worked at all levels of the mental health and addiction system, from being a psychiatric aide to being an outpatient alcohol and drug counselor to a case manager, and then various levels of management and supervision until I was asked to be the state mental health and addictions commissioner in 2003.
And I know that I've seen you at some of the Rethinking Psychiatry events. You seem to be also friendly and familiar and collegial with the people active, not necessarily the anti-psychiatry movement, but more as I said, the grassroots sort of approach, the peer support networks and such. So you kind of have your foot in various parts of this of the basically how we deal with, as I said, people in crisis. So maybe you've gotten a sense for, you know, we've heard a lot on the news about how this crisis is really showing up both the inadequacy and underfunding and understaffing of our, you know, our local, regional, and national health system in general, and it's adding to the difficulty in dealing with the spread of this pandemic. But also, you know, there's people are feeling a lot of stress, a lot of anxiety around this. People already have had, you know, whatever mental, emotional issues are possibly feeling them exacerbated. What have you heard from within the system itself as to, you know, how they are possibly feeling more stress from within the system?
Well, I'm hearing different things. You know, one of the things that I'm hearing, I'm also chair of the board of Dual Diagnosis Anonymous of Oregon. And one of the things that Doyle Smith, the executive director, started doing almost right away as soon as the coronavirus crisis began to get more serious here in Oregon, he figured out how to do the what we call DDA meetings, Dual Diagnosis Anonymous meetings, online. And he also set up a chat box on the DDA Facebook page. Already we've had 150 people sign into the 12-step plus 5 DDA meetings. So they're now on a virtual basis. So I guess one of the reactions that I'm seeing is a lot of creativity. There's a very good article, too, by Leah Harris in Madden America's website. And she's put together a very interesting story about the Western Massachusetts program. And again, they have gone to various kind of things like creating 6-foot standard for distance, in even in their crisis respite program, which is a peer respite program. You know, certainly people who've been in the mental health system are having all the same kind of reactions that everybody else does. This is a human reaction to, as you say, fear and anxiety and stress. But I guess what one of the things that I'm hearing is a lot of creativity. In many ways, they've been doing some of the things to create less of a sense of isolation for a long time.
Uh-huh. I just realized I should go to my Facebook page to see if anybody's actually checked in here. I have to kind of click back and forth on different pages on my computer. This is very, very interesting way to. We're all having to be creative in the face of this. Certainly at KBOO, we're facing challenges, and obviously, you know, everybody's going online. So are people? There must be like therapeutic sessions online too, I assume.
What I'm hearing so far is a lot of the community mental health programs really are I don't know if scrambling is the right word, but they're certainly stressed too, figuring out how to continue to do therapy, to do intake assessments. And I know that one of the things I'm hearing is they're also moving to online assessments. I don't think that's ideal. I don't think anybody who works in a community mental health system, like I have done too, is that comfortable with the kind of adaptations they're having to take place. But I think there's a lot of stress in the community mental health system about how to adapt to the changing environment that we have socially.
Uh-huh. I mean, since you're here in Oregon, I know you have ties nationally and probably internationally. Have you heard anything specifically, you know, about the how people in the Portland area and beyond have been challenged in dealing with this?
I probably shouldn't try to speak too authoritatively to what's happening in other parts of the country. I am directing, as you mentioned, the Continuing Education Project for Madden America, and the series of webinars that we're doing, and we just started, are on innovative approaches to working with people who are suicidal. So I think one of the things that people need to be aware of at this point is the probably the major risk factor for people become suicidal isn't depression, although there's people often feel very down, obviously, but unemployment is a critical factor. If you look at the first webinar, it was conducted by Robert Whitaker, the investigative medical journalist who directs the Mad America Project. He clearly laid out what the research tells us, and that is that unemployment is one of the biggest risk factors.
Uh-huh. And you had mentioned you work with the dual diagnosis group. I should probably just mention at the outset, there are quite a number of grassroots, as I said, grassroots resources, such as Portland Hearing Voices, Folk Time, and others. I will try to link to all of them on my program page. But talk a little bit about, you'd mentioned the dual diagnosis approach being like a 12-step approach, which people are obviously familiar with you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, and Narcotics Anonymous and such, which is really a truly grassroots space with, you know, people meeting in church basements. And is, I think now I've read that it's kind of been over the years sort of there's been some disagreement over the how well the approach really works, but it seems like the most recent research I've heard that AA 12-step approach actually is a very effective approach, if only because it actually, you know, connects people socially who might be, you know, drowning in their own problems or dealing, being so alone in their own in problems. So talk a little bit about how that you know, the 12-step more kind of grassroots person-to-person approach is effective in what you've seen.
Well, let me give you a little bit of the history real quick. There's a man by the name of Corbett Monica, and Corbett was, I think, has become a legend in his own time. But in 1996, after he was in recovery for his heroin addiction and a lot of anxiety disorder, he began to take people who had similar kinds of problems to regular NA and AA meetings. He found that they weren't real well accepted, and it even went to the extent that occasionally he would be told not to bring a certain kind of person back. And instead of going and feeling badly about it, he created the Dual Diagnosis Anonymous 12-step plus 5 approach. He ended up in Oregon, and he wasn't getting very much attention either. When I was the Mental Health and Addictions Commissioner, he showed up in my office and explained what he had done, and I liked it a lot. He had no real history. I'd never met him here before, but I had an opportunity to funnel $50,000 to him in 2006, and that was the beginning of DDA in Oregon. That's now almost 15 years ago. They started off with a budget of $50,000. Their budget has gotten in the neighborhood of $500,000. I think that says a lot about the current leadership, Doyle Smith, who has been really active in outreaching to all kinds of organizations, including corrections programs and Oregon State Hospital. So we have about 4,000 contacts per month in the meetings that we hold. So I think that people who are struggling with both mental health and alcohol and drug issues have really found an ideal vehicle for them to connect with other people, to give tips on recovery process, and just really provide each other with a lot of emotional support. So I think Dual Diagnosis Anonymous is a real success story. We recently, about 2 years ago, helped seed meetings in the UK, in London, and I understand that there are at least 6 meetings in London now of the DDA approach.
And of course, you know, we're talking about a spectrum here. You know, you're talking about people, the dual diagnosis is, you know, generally people with, you know, both serious, you know, whatever mental disequilibrium, I like to call it, imbalance or crisis, and having to deal with substance abuse. But, you know, with this coronavirus thing that's going around, everybody is feeling it, and everybody is more or less isolated. So, you know, we're all facing various challenges, and we're obviously a challenge to you know, to maintain personal connections, which seem to me, as I said, you know, with the AA approach, it's really the social aspect of it, I think, and the support aspect of, like, having a sponsor who, you know, you can call on at any hour of the day or night, you know, people that you can really rely on to understand what you're going through. But obviously, you know, it's a broader thing that we have such a society that doesn't necessarily make it easy to make connections. So anyway, on the KBOO page, kbo.fm, there's actually a thing called Mental Health and Coping During Coronavirus. It actually came out of the UK. I'm not sure I credit it properly, but I hope they don't mind me using it. It seems important to share information to this time. Anyway, there's a lot of really good advice on there. People might want to go to that. But getting back to the 12-step, and is that a model that you can see possibly not just not just maybe not even just 12-step, but the sort of the grassroots model? Is that something that you can see expanding more outside of the institutional framework?
Well, I certainly hope so. I think the public mental health and addiction systems certainly have a role to play. I've been fairly critical at times of community mental health systems, partly because I've become more and more uncomfortable with the medical model. But I think we have to give credit where credit is due, and community mental health programs, the state hospital, all of these mental health programs, which are mainline programs, are finding more and more that it's really a very worthwhile grassroots peer support approach that really is very cost effective. I think you mentioned too the studies that are showing that NA and AA have a lot of outcome effectiveness. So I think that the public system certainly has a role to play in funding these kinds of peer support movements.
But do they fund them? Well, the funding is a problem, as I said at the outset. It's a problem all across the healthcare, our fragmented and largely privatized healthcare system, where there isn't much coordination and there isn't much funding and support. So, have you struggled within that to try to get more funding, to try to get more priority placed on these things?
Well, in my current role, that's really not something that I have any real direct influence on. But I know that Western Mass, Dual Diagnosis Anonymous, Hearing Voices Network have been very assertive about getting themselves out there and not just waiting for money to come to them, but really talking with people who have resources to support what they're doing. I think they've done a really good job of reaching out. Do they have enough funding? No, I think that they don't. But on the other hand, I see them expanding much more effectively than a lot of mainline mental health and addictions programs.
Uh-huh. Well, again, as you know, this tends to be a very political approach to things, this my Wednesday talk radio program. So we're obviously talking about these specific issues of how individuals are dealing with these things. But we're also talking about how the structures operate to either help or impede people getting the help they need, and it seems like that this, if nothing else, this pandemic is pointing out the deep flaws in inequities all across the board, racial and gender and all the others, and obviously people with mental health challenges often have multiple intersecting issues of oppression and how they're not getting their needs met in the system. So it seems like this is not to say this is an opportunity, but my last show was talking about the rent strike, a proposal which is going out and getting traction widely now and being talked about more and more, even now on mainstream media. That's a direct way. You mentioned, how people not having access to housing being a factor in sometimes even in suicide. And so the economic issues and the health and mental health issues are all very interlocking. So perhaps this is a moment where people will actually be forced to not only get together and help each other directly through these kind of grassroots initiatives, but also to challenge to get money out of the war industries and the big pharmaceutical industries that basically seem to want to pump out massive amounts of psychotropic drugs and opioids instead of actually, dealing more face-to-face with people's issues. Anyway, I just went on a long rant there. Maybe you'd care to respond to some of the things I just said.
Well, I think, too, there's money in the mental health system that I don't think is being well spent. I directed a managed care organization in Southern Oregon for a while, And one of the U.S. senators looked at the Medicaid data on the cost of medications. He found the two highest billers for psychiatric medications in the state were actually down in Southern Oregon. One of them was a child psychiatrist who had billed almost $500,000 worth of Abilify, an atypical antipsychotic. I prefer to call them neuroleptics because there's nothing very specific about their effect on psychoses. But in 1 year, he billed almost $500,000 of psychiatric medications to kids. And to me, that seemed like a misspending of a lot of public mental health dollars. And could we find a way to get at some of those, I think, misspent Medicaid dollars? I think there are ways, but it's going to take a lot of education of the mental health systems, really trying to help move them beyond the medical model that they've used that brings diagnoses and then usually medications along with it. But you can't just have people stop taking their medications. That's very dangerous because they're going to have withdrawal effects for the most part. There's a lot of talk about antidepressants and the withdrawal syndromes that come from that. And they vary. Some people, though, can have withdrawal effects for a year or longer. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is that I think there is money in the system that could be spent differently, but it would take quite a bit of effort to get people to think differently about how they approach mental health issues. I just noticed in yesterday's Psychiatric Times, which is an American Psychiatric Association newsletter, it started off talking about the isolation that everyone is experiencing to some degree or another, leading to loneliness, and that can then lead to diagnoses of personality disorders, anxiety disorders, and depression diagnoses. And the risk there is that when people begin to get those diagnoses, they are almost always, if they're in a mainline program, prescribed medications. And that doesn't really deal with isolation and loneliness. Those are issues that I think the grassroots peer movement is expert at in ways that the mainline mental health system really is not very good at.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of the issues of if people do want to try to come off of psychiatric drugs, if they feel they're not necessarily addressing fully or well their problems, there's an Icarus Project guide called the Harm Reduction Guide to Coming Off Psychiatric Drugs, which is on the Rethinking Psychiatry website. And they also have an extensive alternative mental health resource list. They're right at the top of the page. That's rethinkingpsychiatry.org. That's an important resource. Again, I have a link to that website on my program page at kbo.fm. I know we're not able to take phone callers directly, but again, the number is, if you want to give our board op, Tammy, that your question or comment, 503-231-8187. I wonder if we have any of those already. Possibly.
Not quite yet, but it sounds good on my end. I'm here waiting for those calls.
Okie doke. 503-231-8187. That's the number to call to give your comment or question to Tammy, who's there at the board. Volunteers are not going to the station now. KBOO has put that policy in place, obviously, like many other organizations and businesses, to keep people safe. And so there's a limited access, and we really appreciate our staff members for keeping the station going. And for all the programmers who are able to keep their music and public affairs shows going on the air. And we appreciate you listeners for continuing to listen and support the station. I know that our April membership drive is either going to be very different or not going to be happening. You'll probably hear more about that. So any support you can give, you can again go to our website and go to the donate button and help us out. I know everybody is strapped, so any support that people can give obviously is extremely appreciated. This is, I think, a vital resource in at all times, but especially in times of crisis. Again, I'm speaking with Bob Nickel, who was the State of Oregon's commissioner for both mental health and addictions from 2003 to 2008. He's also involved with MAD in America, an excellent resource. The Science, Psychiatry, and Social Justice is on their masthead on their website. And we're talking about mental health challenges in the time of the pandemic. I'm Paul Rowland, the regular host. This is a first Wednesday show focusing on mental and emotional health and liberation and grassroots alternatives. So, until we get some callers, and I said my Facebook page. I haven't seen anybody on that. I really don't know how operative it is. This is the first time I actually tried to use it. But I'd appreciate if anyone who's on Facebook could go to KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio and like it and shoot me a comment or a question. So let's again go back to the issue of dealing with the stress and how are you personally responding to this situation? Obviously, I assume you're sheltering in place yourself.
Well, yes, I am, and I've got a lot of work going on. I mentioned the the webinars that I direct, and we have the series on suicide that we're just on the beginning stages of. We have Dr. Paula Kaplan from Harvard doing our next webinar, and she's going to talk about alternative ways of doing clinical work with people who are suicidal, and she's going to call into question many of the traditional ways. So I've got another series that I'm still sort of in the middle of on system change. So we had, I think last week we had Malcolm Aquinas, who is a peer mentor at Oregon State Hospital. He's actually in a project that I started about 15 years ago. I called it the Peer Services Recovery Team, and they're now the Peer Services, I called it Peer Bridges, I'm sorry, and they're now the Peer Services Recovery Team. And Malcolm did an incredible job, I think, of talking about the dynamics that happen in institutional settings. So I guess the point here is that I've got all of my work with the webinars that I'm in the middle of, so that takes up a certain amount of time. I'm also doing a certain amount of informal consultation. I talked this past week with a peer in Wales in the UK. I've been for some time doing some informal consultation with another really interesting peer project in New Zealand, and it's called the Mind Tribe, And they have peer support meetings for people who want to think about withdrawing from psychiatric medications, and they don't try to convince anybody that they should go off. It's a place where people can talk openly about their psychiatric medications. They can provide each other some peer supports if they want to begin to reduce dosages. They can caution each other about things not to do, like stopping immediately too abruptly. So that's a very interesting project that I've really enjoyed talking with. There's another organization in the Netherlands, Empatico, and Empatico is creating some ways of providing supports from people who have been diagnosed with people who have not been diagnosed. And the idea there is that we don't need people who are in a one-up, one-down situation. We need people who can really relate to each other as human beings. So I have those kinds of consultation projects that I'm working on. I also go for a four-mile run just about every day, and that gets me literally out of the house.
I'm very thankful that I am very close to the I-205 bike trail near my house, and also near Mount Tabor. And it's interesting that I've seen how, you know, the whole social distancing thing has kind of evolved. You know, a couple weeks ago there was this people just walking right next to each other. Now we definitely seem to take care to, you know, give ourselves as much space as we can as we're on the trails. It's good to see people out there, but good to see people being careful. And just while I'm thinking about it, about being out in public, this is an important thing that I think more people are picking up on. I just noticed that the CDC is actually considering recommending face coverings going out in public. I realized that I actually had a couple N95 masks that I had bought months ago for some sort of a remodeling project, I think, in the house, and wore one for the first time to a supermarket I try to go out like, you know, as much little as I can, maybe once a week to shop for me and my mom. And anyway, it was a little awkward. You know, I only saw, I think, one other person in the store. But I think we should definitely not be shy or embarrassed at this time to do whatever we need to do. If you feel like you need to, you know, move off the sidewalk and move away from other people, do it. If you feel like you need to wear, and they're saying, you know, not just necessarily N95 masks. There's a lot of discussion about this issue, but I think it seems to be more widely recognized that any kind of face covering, because we're supposed to assume that we all might be carrying this virus, and so we all might be possibly propagating it. So the idea is you're not necessarily just protecting yourself from others, which it's somewhat less effective at, apparently, because stuff can seep in. But any kind of facial covering, a bandana, a scarf, just a regular, not N95 mask, can be effective in reducing your ability to spread this. So I think it bears constant repetition that it's important that we, you know, do take these steps. I think that, you know, and the more people that do them out in the public, the less people will feel, you know, I think we all just have this natural awkwardness to do something that other people are not doing. I just wanted to say that as something. And while we wait for anybody to call in to 503-231-8187.
We do have some callers in, some questions, whenever you all are ready for them.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. A lot of people are calling in, and they're very thankful that you are talking about this subject matter. So one caller, just going back to the online things that people are doing right now, wanted to know if there are any peer support specialist trainings that are happening online that you are aware of.
Bob? I'm not aware of them, but I'm sure there are some. I just think that you should be asking around to people in your own peer community to see if those things, I'm sure they're going to be happening. I can't give any specific, I don't have specific knowledge of any at this point, but it's pretty early in this process too. I think everyone is really scrambling to figure out how to do things differently and yet get the same functions performed, even if you're not in the same room together.
And again, I would just repeat that the Rethinking Psychiatry website has a extensive list of resources and a lot of these peer support groups and networks, and you can contact them directly. Again, I said Portland Hearing Voices, Folk Time, Reimagining Recovery is an interesting group that's, I have never been to one of their events, but is doing something like, not exactly 12-step, I don't think, but sort of it's like group kind of support meeting type thing. So those are all good resources. Got another question or comment?
Oh, yeah, there are a couple of them. There is a question from Douglas who, wants to get a bit of contact information for your guest, whether it is an email or a website or some sort of digital way of getting in touch with them. And then also, Douglas was wondering if you have any advice for people that are panicking. You know, you mentioned it, like the overbuying of toilet paper and whatever. If you have any advice for people out there to not panic.
Well, it's a good question. I'm not sure I have, I'm not a clinical social worker anymore, and so anything I say is not clinical advice. In terms of people who are panicking, I'm not sure, I don't see that as a psychiatric issue. It's really a behavior issue. It's something that people need to begin thinking very differently about, particularly in the ethics of it, because every time I go in a grocery store or Rite Aid, the shelves for toilet paper and paper towels are stripped bare. And so I think we need to begin thinking more about what other people's needs are. So in some ways, to me, I see it more as an ethical issue, not so much a mental health issue.
Yeah, I mean, one could go off on the strange issue of toilet paper hoarding extensively, but I'm hoping our KBOO listeners in general aren't in that category. But if you are, there are people who actually need it. So if you've got way too much that you're never going to use in the next, 3 months, say, because toilet paper production is going forward, as I understand it. There is no there is no shortage in the supply line of toilet paper. So anyway, we don't need to waste time on that. But the panicking issue obviously goes much further than that. I think one of the things that a lot of cable listeners are probably very diligent followers of the news. You know, Democracy Now comes right before this program, and it's can be kind of heavy duty, a lot of issues I get a lot out of, but there's people who it may not be the best thing to pay so much attention to the news. It's one of the main things on this list that I mentioned, the graphic on my program page, is how to cope with this issue in terms of your mental and emotional state. It's avoid excess exposure to media coverage of coronavirus. So kind of breaking maybe that, we might tend to get into some sort of obsessive patterns. I'll focus on it. Maybe just sort of how to break those patterns. It talks about, breathing, take care of breathing, making time to unwind, remind yourself that strong feelings will fade, take care of your body, take deep breaths, stretch and or meditate, try to eat healthy, exercise regularly to your ability, try not to fall into, obsessive eating patterns and certainly not alcohol and drugs at this time. Connect with others and share your concerns and how you're feeling with friends, family members. Don't hole up, which I myself must say I have sometimes a tendency to do. Anyway, those are just some things that I got of value out of this. You might check it out yourself, but, connect with people. It's a big one. Okay, so any more questions or comments?
Oh, yeah, well, they're piling on in. One comment from a listener, and they wanted to express that in their early 20s, they're now in their 60s, they had a lot of issues, mental health issues, and they had tried every medication that there is, and I'm quoting, and if it wasn't for marijuana, then they wouldn't know where they were. So they wanted to know if self-medicating with marijuana is something that you would recommend as a health professional.
Oh my God, I don't think Bob would probably have any more to say on that. I think if you're, probably not a good time to make drastic changes in your life necessarily. If it's been working for you, that's sort of my common sense, non-clinical. My other thing is a little bit of concern about the lung issue, so probably best not to overdo it since the coronavirus affects the lungs. I mean, again, I can't give advice as a professional, but those are just my sort of human responses, the best I can do. Bob, do you have anything on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm very aware that a lot of people find marijuana helpful for relaxing and so on. A little self-disclosure, back in my 20s, I used it some, and I had kind of the opposite reaction. I got myself very confused. And I stopped using it because for me, I was having a very negative reaction. So I think, like you say, you have to be cautious about those kind of approaches to relaxing. Now, if you haven't been doing them, I guess I'd be pretty reluctant to suggest that. One reason Dual Diagnosis Anonymous is so much needed and popular is that so many people have mental health issues, also have alcohol and drug issues. And I had a study done when I was Mental Health and Addictions Commissioner, and I asked our data people to identify everyone who'd had at least one mental health enrollment in public mental health and one enrollment in alcohol and drug. I was able to match that, not with disclosing names, but I was just able to match that with death records, with all things. And I found that the people who had both enrollments were dying at the average age of 45 years old in Oregon. So this combining alcohol and drug with mental health issues is not a very smart thing to do in terms of if you want to stay healthy and keep yourself alive as long as possible. Those are, combining them can be very risky. Also, many of the people who end up in prisons and jails are struggling with both sets of issues. One of the first things I learned, too, is that alcohol and drug misuse can mimic just about any mental disorder there is. So I just think that it's really good advice to be very, very cautious about that. If marijuana has been helpful to you in the past, I wouldn't question that. But I just think it's something to be very, very cautious about.
And of course, we must realize that we're not just going out to states where it's legal. So there's other issues to perhaps listeners around the country on that. But before I go to a question I got actually on my cell phone, Bob, we forgot that Douglas also wanted to get some contact info for you. Is there something you can give out publicly, or you want to? Is that something you can give out publicly?
Well, yeah, if I get overwhelmed, I'll have to back off some on it. But you feel free to use my email address, which is Bob Nickel, all one word, BobNickel@gmail.com.
Okay, and I can possibly put that up after I consult afterwards with Bob on the website as well. So let's see, we've got a listener who says, this is definitely for you, Bob, should government shut down stakeholder councils that support the consumer voice during this healthcare crisis?
Good question. I had actually a heads up that question might be coming in. So I thought about it a little bit. And my reaction is there's never a good time to stop getting input from people who have been there and done that. So I wouldn't ever recommend that the coronavirus crisis lead to reducing the input that people who have been experienced in the system and have dealt with their own issues. I think it's a very critical time to keep hearing from people. One thing that I think people don't always recognize is that folks who have been there and done that are pretty creative. They come up with some pretty good ideas. And so I guess the short answer to that is no, I wouldn't recommend that government agencies begin to cut back on their task forces. I would encourage task forces to be concrete in what they're trying to accomplish. I've been in too many of those kinds of task forces and meetings where it just seems like there's endless talk or there's endless planning. So I think one of the things that people who have experienced these issues themselves need to push for is concrete actions and not just talking.
Okay. Well, back to Tammy. Got any more questions or comments from our listeners?
Definitely. Let's see. Listener, I think Sam is the name, wanted to know if you read Johan Hari's book, Our Lost Connection, and his outlook on treatment of depression, and also how he manages to input universal basic income into it as a treatment for depression.
Bob, you familiar with that book?
Well, I have the book in my library. I think I've read it sometime. And I think generally has a lot of good things to say. And, one of the things that the state has done well is fund something that we called supported housing. And I'm not even sure if that's still going on, but it was considered a component of mental health care. I think the housing issue is something that's often overlooked. It's pretty hard to keep your mental health stability if you're not housed safely. So I think that part of the book makes a lot of sense to me.
Okay. I just thought I'd read, since I think it kind of sheds a little bit of light about this article, just a couple paragraphs from the, where I already knew of you, but I was, when I was looking for someone to speak to the subject of mental health issues and the coronavirus, so Oregon's burdened mental health system faces new challenges from coronavirus. This is on the KGW8 website. The coronavirus pandemic has fueled anxieties across society as people stay at home and avoid others and worry about contracting a deadly disease. Oregon's mental health system was overloaded before coronavirus hit the state. COVID-19 adds a new challenge for clinics already suffering from a lack of workers and inadequate public funding. Providers and support groups are now scrambling to help a vulnerable segment of the population that often suffers the most when a disaster strikes. We have a badly underfunded mental health system that's overburdened by people in a normal situation, said Jason Renaud, an advocate with the Mental Health Association of Portland. This is going to completely overrun it. The coronavirus pandemic has fueled anxieties across society as people stay at home and avoid others and worry about contracting deadly disease. It's even worse for people suffering from anxiety disorders, depression, and other conditions, mental health experts said. Facing stepped-up demand, hospitals, clinics, and providers serving mental health patients have had to shift their practices. I'll just step in. That's an interesting thing I hadn't thought of. As you know, as the wave crests around the country, including here in Oregon, and hospitals are scrambling for beds for COVID-19 patients, and taking away, you know, discouraging people who are having non-elective surgeries and other things, it's probably having a whatever the word is, knock-on effect on people searching for help within the, you know, established health system. I know there's the Unity Center that was established to sort of take some of the weight from that, but I'm sure across the board this is creating problems. Anyway, this article goes on. I've linked to it on my webpage. You have any further responses before we go to our next question or comment, Bob?
I think Jason is raising some important issues, and you know, I think one of the adaptations, if I were in charge of a mental health program, I might think about seeing if there was an interest in having coronavirus anxiety support groups. I'm not sure what I would call it exactly, but that is an issue that everybody is struggling with, and people who may not normally feel as anxious and fearful are feeling it now. And it doesn't mean they have a mental disorder, but it does mean that some forms of peer support might be useful to consider. So I'm sure there are other adaptations that are being considered. And as I mentioned, I've heard that some assessments are being done with video capabilities, and other kinds of services are being developed that are more online in nature and not being two people in a room or group therapy.
Uh-huh. And I just remembered that there's a couple of COVID-19 sort of mutual aid. There's a general support Facebook group and a COVID-19 mutual aid, PDX COVID-19 mutual aid network, which are probably good places. And there's probably people thinking about these issues and forming grassroots sort of networks as we speak that I'm not even aware of. I neglected to include them on my web page, the page program page, but those are other resources. I will definitely link to them. Back to Tammy, another question or comment?
Yes. A listener, didn't grab their name, wanted to mention that there is some sort, or wanted to comment on a question that an earlier listener had about the peer trainings, and he mentioned that Cascadia Behavior Health is planning on doing some sort of online virtual peer training session group. So that's something that he mentioned is worth checking out. And then another caller, Jared, called and asked, they are interested in getting into the, I guess, public health field, and they are wondering if it's better to be a social worker versus a health provider, a mental health provider. What would be the differences, and which do you think is better?
Well, social workers are mental health providers in many cases, and you know, I'm probably biased. I have an MSW from the University of Kansas, and I got very good training there in family therapy. Other options are marriage and family therapy, licensed professional counselors, nurses, psychologists. There are a number of professional categories that are doing, frankly, most of the mental health care.
Where would people go to find out more about, you know, the differences in approaches, like different training programs, schools? Do you know where people might go to find out more about that?
Well, I would recommend just Googling psychology training, social work trainings, graduate programs, and begin to get a feel for what people are talking about in those kind of programs for those professionals.
Okay. Well, again, this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm a regular host, Paul Rowland. This is the first Wednesday focus on mental and emotional health and liberation and grassroots alternatives to some of the important, some cases deficient existing institutional institutions and institutional framework, which are largely based on what is called the medical model, which we haven't really got into. Maybe you want to say a couple words about the medical model. We've talked about that on this show a fair amount, but it bears always repeating.
Yeah, I think the assumption of most mental health programs, and I'm saying most, I don't think it's all, are that mental health issues are chemical imbalances. And when you confront people who believe that and ask them to give you the evidence of what the chemical imbalances is, they really can't give you anything very specific. They can talk about dopamine supersensitivity, they can talk about things, but there's no real direct link between biological disorders, biological imbalances, and mental health diagnoses. So I think that's a challenge. And frankly, there's pretty good evidence that people who take long-term psychiatric medications end up, for the most part, not doing as well in terms of functioning. So I think the medical model has led us down a path that tells us that we can restore chemical imbalances with psychiatric drugs. And it ignores too much, I think, the issues of trauma. And so I think the alternative model is questioning the medical model upon which so much is based now. And so I would encourage people to read books like Mad in America, read Anatomy of an Epidemic, and the works of those researchers like Robert Whitaker, who have really taken an in-depth look at this.
Mm-hmm. And I just noticed that actually my messages on my Facebook page are coming on the right-hand side rather than on the what I usually think of as the feed in the middle. So anyway, so Kevin Fitz actually asks, how many old models of community mental health services may go out of business due to COVID-19? That's an interesting question.
Yeah, Kevin is a longtime friend of mine. He and I met for the first time 30 years ago when the Mind Empowered Incorporated was operating in Oregon, I just have to mention this. This is one of the most influential experiences I've ever had. We assigned people who had been patients at the state hospitals and who had figured out how to live successfully in the community. We trained them how to do case coordination, care management, whatever you want to call it. I don't care for those terms as much, but that's what it was. And we assigned them 30 to 35 of the most difficult to discharge patients at Damage State Hospital. Kevin was involved in that project, and it was successful. That was a very important experience for me to realize the value, incredible effectiveness that people who've been there and done that can have with other people. They establish an almost immediate rapport. So Kevin and I go way back, and Kevin always asks very interesting questions. He's one of the brightest people I've encountered in the mental health system. He's been a longtime advocate. And sometimes troublemaker, and I think sometimes the system needs some troublemakers.
We like good troublemakers on KBOO and Wednesday Talk Radio. And yeah, he's been on the show as well. Well, we've only got a couple minutes left. I'm not going to ask you to wrap it all up completely, which is always difficult. But we've been dealing with a bunch of issues. Well, let me just ask Tammy if maybe there's one more pertinent question or comment before we go off the air.
We are good here. Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks, Tammy. Great work. Appreciate it. Anything that we hadn't talked about that you wanted to talk about or that sparked you got sparked as we talked?
Well, I really liked your list of great ways of taking care. One of the things you didn't mention that I like a lot is, you know, one of the interesting effects of the coronavirus crisis is humor. For example, I saw a picture the other day, and it was Martians who were trying to decide whether to land on Earth, and one was telling the other one, it's not time now, they're fighting over toilet paper. So I think those kind of humorous approaches really have some value. You asked earlier too what I was doing, and one thing that I do is plug in my earpods and I listen to what is great music, classical music and good swing jazz. So I think those are things that I would add to that list, but I think the list is really good.
And of course, KBOO always provides excellent music and public affairs for your interest and stimulation. And I just want to say Jacqueline Keeler, my second Wednesday co-host, who I believe is going to be on next week. She sent me a link to some a couple guys. I don't know. I really like Native American humor. It's always very unique. Anyway, they sent this. I'll link to it. I'll find it and link to it. You really got to check it out. It's hilarious. Well, with that, we got to go. Bob Nickel, thank you so much for taking time out of your day and spending it here on Wednesday Talk Radio.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been good to talk with you.
Okay. Well, that wraps it up for today's show. Back to Tammy and more programming here on KBOO.
KBOO Portland. The time is just about 9 a.m. And as you know, the station right now is currently closed to all in-station volunteer and visitor activity for the next upcoming while due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Effective March 13th, while airwaves are still live and all in-station classes and meetings are canceled for the month, our KBOO values and health and safety for our communities come first, so we're taking operational precautions to do our part. For more information how KBOO is combating COVID-19, you can go to kboo.fm/COVID-19. Stay tuned and let's stay connected. We are your community connection, KBOO Portland.